Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Great to have you along. Happy Monday to you. There's a quote in the book we're going to reference today from T.S. Eliot, and it says this: "The problem of leading a Christian life in a non-Christian society is now very present to us. And as for the Christian who's not conscious of his dilemma, and he is in the majority, he is becoming more and more de-Christianized by all sorts of unconscious pressure. Paganism holds all the most valuable advertising space." We're going to learn how to maybe work our way through culture to understand it, and particularly how to help the next generation navigate today's world. That's the conversation ahead, and looking forward to sharing that with you in a moment. Just want to say welcome again. And Ted, we should mention, I think, that just it doesn't necessarily mean a lot to everyday folks, but the end of the fiscal year coming up for Faith Radio here at the end of this month.
Just 3 weeks left of this fiscal year. Yeah. And if you haven't given, maybe you've given in the past and said, I'll do it later. Well, now would be the time then to help us make our budget goals for the year.
And it just kind of helps our finish up our books well. And so, I mean, you'll have lots of ministry, lots of opportunities to do that for a lot of people wrapping up fiscal years here at the end of the month. But appreciate your ongoing support, and thanks for listening to Faith Radio. Let me jump in to get to our guests right away. We've got a lot to talk about. John Stonestreet, you hear him regularly on Breakpoint here on Faith Radio, and Breakpoint this week with Ed Stetzer. He's president of the Colson Center for Christian Worldview and co-hosts Breakpoint, and has co-authored several books, including the new one we're going to reference today called A Practical Guide to Culture. And it's particularly about helping the next generation navigate today's world. And that's something that John has been concerned and passionate about for a number of years. He lives in Colorado Springs, does a lot of teaching and speaking. John, welcome back to Connecting Faith. Good to have you on.
Hey, it's great to be with you, Neil. Thanks so much.
I know that you've been teaching and helping equip young people for many years in this area of culture, and we want to jump in. Is that something that just came because you were encouraged maybe in your teen years by a mentor to help you understand the biblical worldview?
Well, it was a little bit later on, actually. It was really in college where I started to realize that faith wasn't just something that kept me from the world, but faith is something that led me to engage the world, and that really culture wasn't this, all the bad stuff in the world that we needed to stay away from, but culture was actually part of what it means to be human, created in the image of God. God wants us to make culture, and humans can't not engage culture. And so being thoughtful rather than reactionary about it was a pretty major shift in my spiritual formation somewhere in college. And it just really put me on a journey to talk about issues surrounding Christian worldview and what's happening in the culture. And, of course, getting to know Chuck Colson and working with Chuck and then taking over the Breakpoint radio program, which he founded, was a huge part of that. I mean, Chuck was trying to help Christians understand culture and make a difference in culture, you know, for a really long time. And he was doing it better than anybody, I think. And so, you know, being able to work with him over the last couple years of his life until he passed away in 2012 was also a big part of that journey for me.
Can we talk in culture, I guess, as Christians in terms of boundaries? I mean, you talk about maybe the line approach that doesn't necessarily work. I mean, you know, talk about how we engage or relate to culture.
Well, I think we, in a time of dramatic cultural upheaval, which is something I think many parents and mentors and teachers feel right now. I mean, things have gone from being unthinkable to unquestionable and just record speed. I mean, we know that culture was moving, but it seems like for many of us, it's been a tsunami, you know, just recently, particularly on issues of sexuality. But anytime, you know, I think especially as parents and mentors of the next generation, we're trying to help them navigate culture, it's really tempting to just punt to a what I call a line approach, where we kind of draw a line through the middle of the world and say, okay, everything that's on this side of the line is good and everything on that side of the line is bad. And, you know, when I was growing up, it was, you know, essentially, you know, going to movies was bad, or playing cards was bad, or, you know, anything that wasn't Christian music was bad. And listen, some of those things were very bad. I mean, the reason that that line approach makes a lot of sense is because there are things in the culture that we don't want our kids to be exposed to. But Jesus, we weren't created by God or recreated by Jesus just to stay away from the world. In fact, God created humanity, if you go back to the garden, to be fruitful, multiply, and subdue the earth, fill the earth and subdue it. That's what many theologians call the cultural mandate, this idea that we're actually supposed to create culture. In fact, humans can't not create culture. So the problem is sometimes when we say that culture itself is bad, culture is more than just the bad stuff that happens in the world. As Christians, we're called to do something with culture. We're called to champion what's good and to fight what's evil and to restore what's broken. And even in times when we're trying to protect our kids from the bad stuff in the world, we have to keep in mind our ultimate purpose with culture and not just react to the bad stuff. Now, again, you got to get to lines. I mean, we talk in there very clearly when it comes to things like pornography or something like that to draw very clear boundaries and to have very clear geographical boundaries to keep kids safe from that stuff. But at the same time, we need to first and foremost understand that God is trying to raise up a new generation to not only stay safe from culture, but to engage culture and make a difference in it.
In fact, I think you describe it or maybe distinguish that, you know, we're saved for, not just saved from. Say a little bit more about that.
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly right. We talk a lot about it as Christians, what we're saved from. We're saved from sin, from the condemnation of God because of our sin. And man, if that's all there was to salvation, that's still a great deal. And we should take that every day of the week. We may talk about sometimes what we're saved to, that we're saved to heaven when we die, we're saved to the glory of God. All of that is true as well. But a lot of the New Testament is not talking about what we're saved from or saved to. It's talking about what we're saved for, and that we're saved for, as one theologian put it, the life of the world. We're actually called to bring restoration and healing into the world. In fact, the Apostle Paul is really clear on this in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, where he says that those who have been reconciled are given the ministry of reconciliation. And so, you know, basically taking an approach where we just hide from the world is not wise. Now, coming up with the wise strategies, making sure our institutions are equipped to help form kids so that they can actually make good decisions about the culture, that's a non-negotiable. That's a given. But what we ultimately want them to do is to move into the areas that God has called them. Maybe it's ministry and missions. Maybe it's law and politics and entertainment and artistry. But we want them to grow into that so that they can actually become the reconcilers that God has ultimately reconciled them to become.
Are the issues facing this generation new and unique for Christians trying to live out their faith? I mean, there was a time, obviously, when the barbarians overran, you know, societies. I mean, can we look back in history and say, no, this is definitely, as you say, maybe unthinkable and unquestionable?
Well, I mean, look, we're not the first generation of Christians to face a culture of sexual brokenness or a culture where to be a Christian is not only to be kind of considered quaint and outdated, but to be considered somewhere between wrong, dangerous, and evil. We're not the first generation of Christians to face a very difficult cultural moment. There are new things to our cultural moment, at least in terms of the last, several generations. So those of us that have watched some of these kind of, cosmic shifts take place in our society, for example, from seeing people as ultimately valuable because of who they are as made in the image of God to seeing people as basically the sum total of their sexual inclinations or choices. That's a pretty dramatic shift that we talk about in the book. And so in that sense, there are new things that we're facing, at least in our lifetime. But no, we're not the first generation of Christians to face a very difficult cultural moment, one in which the pressure is increasing. In fact, one of the things we say in the book is that a book of scripture that every Christian should spend a whole lot of time in right now is 1 Peter. In 1 Peter, Peter is writing to a group of Christians who are facing kind of an increasing oppression and persecution under Nero. And the lessons there are very applicable to what we're facing today.
John Stonestreet is my guest today. We're talking about today, how we navigate and live through culture today, and particularly how we help the next generation navigate today's world. And I know that is a concern of all of ours, you know, whether we have children or grandchildren, or just are maybe have kids in the neighborhood, or, you know, brothers and sisters we're concerned about. We want to know how to live it out well and pass the faith along. What does that look like? We're getting a good insight from John Stonestreet today. New book that's just come out called A Practical Guide to Culture, Helping the Next Generation Navigate Today's World. Do you have a copy to give away? And would love to have you sign up for it. We do that drawing at the end of the hour, so you can give us a call at 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH, and we'll put your name in the drawing for John Stonestreet's new book, A Practical Guide to Culture. And we're going to continue our conversation in a moment. We'll talk a little bit about the information age and about cultural champions, all those things just ahead. Stay tuned. Finding that finding the boundaries, understanding our way, navigating, if you will, navigating today's world. That's what this new book from John Stonestreet and Brent Kunkel is all about. A Practical Guide to Culture, Helping the Next Generation Navigate Today's World. John is president of the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, the co-host of Breakpoint, and authored a number of books. And we're honored to have him with us today on Connecting Faith. John, you quote C.S. Lewis several times in the book, but one of them just caught my attention. He talked about dangerous ideas in our society. He said that, you know, it's a good thing probably that we're willing to debate those. So is that good news that we can still argue about maybe the definition of marriage or gender? Or are there a growing number of ideas that are just considered normal now and don't even show up for debate?
Well, I think there are a growing number of issues that our culture often, or at least, you know, through media, education, or so on, would want us to think is, you know, either settled science or a settled issue. And that's really one of the things that we wanted to point out in the book. I mean, as parents, we feel those, what we call in the book, cultural waves. I mean, if you're ever standing on the side of the ocean, you get hit by a wave, you know it, right? I mean, you felt it. And we feel like we've got hit by waves. You know, we've been hit by waves like same-sex marriage and pornography and addiction and entertainment and things like that. But as Lewis said, that the more dangerous things happening in a society aren't the things that are actually open for debate or that are that noisy, but the ones that are assumed. We've also had that experience of being in an ocean and then looking up and, you know, after playing at the beach and looking up and being 40, 50 yards down the beach and say, well, how did that happen? How did I get all the way down here? And that's the undercurrents. And the undercurrents aren't often felt. A lot of the issues in our culture maybe are up for debate for us, Neil, but for our kids, they never hear another side of the story. So one of the things we want parents to do, and as parents we've got to do, is we've got to be intentional to highlight. Culture is most powerful in what it portrays to be normal, not in what it argues. So just kind of what is normal kind of business of the day. And a lot of people don't understand that when it comes to these dramatic, you know, shifts in sexuality or other issues. They seem to still be debatable issues for us, but when it comes to media, when it comes to their classes, when it comes to the cultural forces in a society, those things have already been settled. And so we're going to have to walk our kids through learning a critical eye. What I mean by a critical eye is not a mean eye, but a critical in terms of a thoughtful, a discerning eye, so that they can realize when assumptions are being made that are counter to the biblical story. So that's a very important insight on culture. Sometimes we kind of, as Christians, run to where culture is the noisiest. But culture is the most effective where it's not making any noise at all, but it's just portraying a set of beliefs, an idea, a lifestyle, or whatever as being normal and no longer up for debate.
I hear you say often on the Breakpoint that ideas have consequences. And in the book, you reference that again, but also talk about, you know, bad ideas have victims. I hadn't really thought about that. But, you know, do we have enough sort of capacity to even think through and raise some of those questions about the ideas? Or are we, you know, as you said, are we just happy to say, well, let's let it be settled science, particularly for our kids today?
Well, listen, I mean, we can. I mean, that's the thing. I think a lot of – that's one of the reasons that Brett and I were really encouraged to write this book. Both of us are dads, by the way. If you ask my co-author, Brett Kunkel, why he wrote the book, he'd say he had five reasons. And if you ask me, I'll say I have four reasons. And the five reasons for him are his five kids. The four reasons for me are my four kids. And, you know, and it does seem like things are moving so fast. And we knew that parents just needed a very practical guide to some of the really important issues. But they also needed some help navigating these undercurrents that kind of go unnoticed. And they need to understand what are the forces shaping the culture. Because if they're not intentional about it, if we are not intentional about it with our kids, then our kids will be the victims of bad ideas. And it's a very true maxim that ideas have consequences. Ideas aren't just kind of disembodied concepts that you study at college, but ideas actually walk out into the real world, particularly when we're talking about ideas having to do with what's right and wrong or who we are as human beings or anything like that. And because they walk out into the real world, bad ideas, those that don't correspond with reality, that aren't true, that are deceptive, they're going to make victims of our kids. So not walking our kids into this culture is not an option either.
Does the information age kind of hinder us because everything is so readily available, but maybe we have a lot of information but not a lot of wisdom?
Yeah, that's one of the things. As we talk about the undercurrents that are taking place in our culture, the information age is the first one. You know, a student growing up today would encounter more information on a daily basis than someone who lived in the 1200s would have seen during their entire life. And there's a lot of great stuff about information. But there's two things that have shifted because of the plethora of information that we have. The first one is just that information is not the same thing as knowledge. Having access to information, being able to Google anything we want, that's not the same thing as being a wise person. And so information can kind of become a bad substitute for wisdom. The other thing is that it actually creates a crisis of discernment. You know, when you and I were growing up and we wanted to know the answer to a question, our parents would say, look it up. And by that, they meant, go get that book off the shelf, an authoritative book, right? An encyclopedia or a dictionary. Today, when you say to your kids, look it up, they say, well, give me your phone and I'll Google it. Well, Google is not. Is Google an authoritative source, or is the, you know, the 10 or 15 or 20 web pages that it pulls up, is that an authoritative source? So kids today need, and this is what, actually, interestingly enough, what Paul prayed for the church at Philippi is that they needed, you know, Paul said that I pray that your love would abound more and more in truth and in all discernment. Discernment is the antidote for living in an age of information because we live in a culture where kids are going to need to be able to tell the difference between what's true and what's false, what's genuine, what's counterfeit, but also between sources that are reliable and worthy of our trust and those sources which aren't. And living in a culture of information kind of flattens out those authority sources. So that's one of the things we've got to navigate with our kids.
You talk about the, you know, information doesn't necessarily equal knowledge. You also bring up in the book, throughout the book, there's the big story. Are we living in a story-less culture? We've got information, but we don't really have a story.
Yeah, well, that is. There's a real fragmentation about our society as the traditional family breaks down, as we're, you know, connected by more devices, but not necessarily in deep relationship with each other. When we live in one of the chapters in the book, we talk about what it means to live in a pluralistic culture. In other words, a culture where everyone has their own story, and to say that one story is more true or more right than another is to be offensive. You know, these are real challenges that kids face on an everyday level. But that's the brilliant thing about Christianity. A lot of Christian kids learn to approach the Bible and what Philip Yancey had, you know, called kind of the moral McNugget approach, where basically we live our lives. We live in our society and our culture, and we turn around and we look for those Bible verses that we can take and apply to our lives. But that's not what the Bible's actually offering us. And one of the first things we have to realize as Christians is that the Bible is bigger than the culture we live in. The Bible claims to be the story, capital S, of the world, the true story, not the true story for us, but the true story for everyone, whether they believe it or not. And reading the Bible as the story of reality helps me understand that that the most true thing about my culture is the story, not that I have to find out which Bible verse fits into my culture. I need to figure out where the culture is in light of God's redemptive history, capital R, capital H, like the big story, capital S, of the world. And so we have a bunch of stuff in the book for parents to teach their kids, not only why to trust the Bible, but how to read the Bible, so that we don't read it in bits and pieces, but we read it as that big story that it is. It's absolutely critical, because they're not going to get a big story, capital S, about what is true, who is God, you know, where's history headed, who are they as human beings, unless we teach them how to read the scriptures well.
Yeah, man, that has to start with us. Are there cultural, you talk about cultural champions today, is that a place where Christians can be in that role? Maybe define what that means.
Well, you know, this is all part of early on in the book where we talk about, okay, how do we actually read culture well, and thinking about, well, what makes culture what it is? Certainly, culture is made up of ideas about life and the world and success and truth and history. All of that stuff makes up the culture in which we live. But there's also the artifacts of culture, the stuff of culture. You know, if you go from, you know, California to deep Mississippi, you'll see two different cultures. But the one thing they'll both have in common is that everyone has a smartphone, right? Or at least almost everyone has a smartphone. There are things that are artifacts of our culture. What I mean by artifacts is just the real tangible stuff that shapes our experience in the world. And so we have an awful lot in the book about how parents can help their kids navigate smartphones and constant glowing rectangles that are in their lives. But there's also the champion aspect, and that is those people who champion ideas to a generation. We can certainly think of political champions. We can certainly think of artistic champions. In fact, the two most effective champions of ideas in a society are the artists and the educators, even more so than the politicians. So what does this mean? Well, right now, those that are championing ideas in our culture tend to do it from a non-Christian perspective. The artists that are making the biggest impact, the politicians, the educators that are making the biggest impact. But this is great opportunity for Christians. And one of the things we talk to parents about in the book is how to help your kids understand who God has called them to be and what God called them to do. We need artists, if for no other, you know, I think C.S. Lewis said we need bad philosophy if for no other reason. Sorry, we need Christian philosophy if for no other reason than bad philosophy exists. And we can just go down the line. We need Christian artists if for no other reason than bad art exists. We need Christian educators if for no other reason. And what we want, again, is our kids not just to survive this cultural moment, but to emerge understanding it and committed to making a difference for the kingdom of God.
Coming up in just a few minutes, we're going to talk a bit more with John Stone Street about some practical areas where we can get some insight. And in fact, in the book, A Practical Guide to Culture, there are action points at the end of each chapter. And so we'll touch on a few action points that John and his co-author, Brett Kunkel, have provided. We talk A Practical Guide to Culture, Helping the Next Generation Navigate Today's World. We do have a copy of this great new book to give away. It's from David C. Cook. We'll do that at the top of the hour. You can sign up for a copy at 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH. And when we get back, we'll dive into a few issues. Maybe it's something you're concerned about. It's the hookup culture or pornography or sexual orientation, gender identity, all those things. We're addressing. John Stone Street is president of the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, co-host of Breakpoint. You hear him every day here on Faith Radio, authored several great books. I recommend his writing, and we'll talk more with John in just a moment as we talk A Practical Guide to Culture. We live out our faith in the world today, particularly how do we pass the faith along to our kids, helping the next generation navigate today's world. That's the subtitle of a new book from John Stone Street and Brett Kunkel called A Practical Guide to Culture. And John is with us today, president of the Colson Center for Christian Worldview. You hear him regularly on Breakpoint. In fact, I recommend you, if you want to find the book, you can, of course, get it at Amazon or any major booksellers, or you can go to the store section at breakpoint.org. Also, find more about John's other books and writings, breakpoint.org. John, in the second half of the book, you talk about going through some of those big issues, cultural concerns, pornography, the hookup culture, sexual orientation. One of the things that I noticed there's in the action point section, you said, you know, we need to take the long view and expect that things maybe will get worse before they get better. Say a bit more about, you know, how we have the long view when it comes to these things and what other practical things we can help our kids with to navigate these pelvic issues.
Well, I mean, I think the long view, ultimately for any Christian, and it sounds, you know, not practical, but I think it's as practical as it gets, is, again, to go back to making sure the kids know the difference between the story and the moment. We all live in a cultural moment, and the cultural moment we live in is in great upheaval, and a lot of pressure is being exerted on traditional Christian conviction, especially on all the issues surrounding sexuality. But with that comes along a threat of kind of being on the wrong side of history. That's a nonsensical phrase. First of all, people can't predict history. Secondly, we know how the story ends. So there's no real there is no such thing as being on the wrong side of history. It's just being on the wrong side of right. And that's ultimately where we want kids to understand. We can't prepare kids for each and every issue they're going to face for the rest of their lives because we don't know what they're going to be. But we can help kids understand that the most true thing about their culture is the truths that are communicated in Scripture, and in particular that they can understand the cultural moment from that perspective. The second thing is to help them understand that Christianity is not just a moral thing, but it's actually true. So the Christian view of sexuality is actually true. And what I mean by that is not that it's true for us and not true for somebody else, because that's no such – but it's just true. It actually corresponds to reality. So right now we have an awful lot of social experimentation being done on the next generation in the name of sexual progress. There's going to be some reckoning in the future by how quick we are, particularly in schools, counselors, and so on, to just entertain a young child's fantasy about changing genders or something like that. We're going forward in the sexual revolution as if we know what the consequences will be. And this isn't the first time we've done it. I mean, we did it with no-fault divorce when the culture said, you know, kids need happy parents, not married parents. I had no statistics to back that claim up, and those statistics were absolutely a counter to that to that line. And then we hear things like, well, kids don't need a mom and a dad, they just need loving parents, when all the research tells us that moms and dads do different things and bring different things into the lives of their children. And we're doing other things in terms of kind of going down the line of the sexual revolution, saying that it's true. This is why kids need that discernment that we talked about earlier, what Nancy Piercy once called a baloney detector, when they can make tell the difference between an assertion and an argument. Helping kids understand all these sexual issues today almost completely rests on helping them understand the difference between an assertion and an argument. An assertion makes a claim. An argument backs up that claim. What happens in our culture is assertions are made about sexuality as if there's something backing them up when there's not. And so one of the more important things to help kids do is just question claims with another question. How do you know that's true? You know, it's really simple, it's really calm, it's really natural. But if kids can sit in a class at their high school or at their college, if kids can watch a movie and identify assertions and then say, well, wait a minute, how do we know that's true? We're way down the line in helping them discern, helping them develop discernment.
Do you, you know, as a parent of four, and you mentioned Brett has five kids, I mean, do you find yourself looking for teachable moments when maybe issues of gender identity come up in the news, or if it's issues of pornography, entertainment, or whatever, consumerism? Do you just say, well, here's a chance to talk, and this is how I'm going to lead, so it's not just John preaching again? Or?
Oh, yeah, almost always. I mean, in fact, I think that's the thing that parents need to realize, is we don't always get to choose the conversations we have with our kids, but we can always choose to have those conversations. And if we're not going to have those conversations, the culture is. For example, we can say, well, I don't want to talk about transgenderism with my kids. Well, the problem with that is we live in a culture that is going to have that conversation with our kids if we do not. There was a lot of media attention around the real life remake of Beauty and the Beast. And a lot of parents were, going to stay away, stay away, stay away. Well, listen, that's a decision that parents need to make, and I respect that decision. What I was thinking with my kids is that, you know, if we don't, we can use that movie to have the conversation. But if not, if there's not a gay moment in Beauty and the Beast that they're going to encounter, it's going to be a gay moment walking down the street in Colorado Springs. And I'm still going to have the conversation. So I don't want the culture to determine necessarily what the conversation, when we have the conversation. I want to get ahead of that as much as possible. And whenever the culture throws something out, man, we're going to talk about it. Look, 15 years ago when my wife and I got married, we did not plan to have a conversation about same-sex marriage with my seven-year-old. But we did the day that the Supreme Court decided that marriage should be expanded to include same-sex couples, the Obergefell decision. Now, we did it in an age-appropriate way. We didn't talk a lot about the mechanics of the homosexual lifestyle, but we did talk about the fact that government sometimes makes mistakes, and here's how this mistake is made, and here's what we know to be true about marriage and family and why it matters. And we had that conversation with them because we want to have the conversation with them on our terms, not the terms that the culture is setting for them.
The book is full of, as the title suggests, a practical guide to culture. It'll deal with issues from sexual orientation to gender identity, affluence and consumerism, addiction, entertainment, racial tension, much more. John Stonestreet and Brett Kunkel have co-written this great new book, Helping the Next Generation Navigate Today's World. We just have a minute or so left, John. With you address virtue in the book, and I'm just wondering how virtue and adolescent maturity are related, and just speak to that a bit.
You know, one of the undercurrents of our culture is this idea of adolescence. And adolescence itself, is a term that has historically been used to describe a transitional stage between being kids and being adults. What's interesting is most cultures throughout the history of the world didn't have adolescence. You just went from being a kid to being an adult. So adolescence really came in the 20th century from Western civilization. But that's okay. But the issue that's happened that we now confront is that adolescence is becoming a longer and longer stage of life. Kids are entering adolescence earlier and earlier and leaving it later and later. So we used to think of adolescence as a 13 to 18 time period. Most people put it as between 11 and 30 now, which is shocking. But we see that with 20-year-olds who are delaying marriage, who aren't settling down, 30-year-old guys who play video games more than 18-year-old guys. It's impacting the marriage culture. It's impacting the pursuit of purity among teenagers and 20-somethings. It's an enormous issue. In fact, Senator Ben Sasse from Nebraska has written extensively on that in a new book, as well as in a Wall Street Journal article from a few weeks ago. And I was encouraged by that because that's what Brett and I had wrote about when we put this book together, is extended adolescence. Just like the antidote to too much information is discernment, the antidote to an adolescent culture is virtue. Virtue is something that we don't talk a lot about anymore. We talk a lot about having Christian values, but virtue formation goes back to Aristotle and C.S. Lewis and Augustine, and there's just this rich history of talking about how to form and model character. And you've got to get as practical as your daily decisions and your daily habits. So in the book, we walk parents through how to not only help their kids develop virtue, but how to evaluate where their kids are when it comes to virtue. And virtue is the antidote to a whole lot of temptation that we see in our culture.
Reading the scriptures to not just as McNuggets, but reading it as the big story and understanding the big story, helping pass on, live out virtue and character in our lives and pass it on to our kids, going to make a difference in helping them navigate today's world. Helping the Next Generation Navigate Today's World, subtitle of a new book from John Stonestreet and Brett Kunkel called A Practical Guide to Culture. John Stonestreet, president of Colson Center for Worldview, co-host of Breakpoint. You can find out more about the book and the great writing and the thinking that's going on every day at the Colson Center at breakpoint.org. John, thank you so much for carving out some time today. I always appreciate the opportunity to visit with you.
You bet. Thanks so much.
John Stonestreet joining us today here on Connecting Faith. Again, you can find out more. Go to breakpoint.org and go to the store section and find out how you can get a copy of Practical Guide to Culture. We do have a copy available, and we'll make that available here with a drawing at the top of the hour at 877-933-2484. That's 877-93-FAITH. Now, coming up in the next few minutes. We got a little bonus Stone Street going on because one of John's more recent books that he co-wrote with Warren Cole Smith is called Restoring All Things, God's Audacious Plan to Change the World Through Everyday People. And you're going to get some encouragement and way to apply your faith in everyday life. We'll get to that coming up. See Christ living in and through us, and that we might truly be light shining in today's culture, making a difference, helping to the next generation navigate today's world is what are talked about here the last few minutes of John Stone Street, A Practical Guide to Culture. John, not too long ago, wrote another great book called Restoring All Things, God's Audacious Plan to Change the World Through Everyday People, and thought we'd just share some more with John as our time allows today and consider what that looks like. How can we actually be part of the change that the world needs?
You address Tocqueville's assessment about America and that important middle ground. Talk about that.
Well, I think a lot of time has been spent over the last couple decades, in terms of Christian engagement of culture, complaining and yelling and screaming at what I call the top of culture. In other words, what's happening in D.C. and Hollywood. And trust me, there's plenty to scream at, and there's plenty to be concerned about. And I'm not saying we should be silent about those things at all, particularly those Christians who have been called into those spheres of influence. I mean, there's remarkable people, in Hollywood, for example, like Mark Burnett or others that are trying to live out their faith in that environment. And then you have people, of course, in D.C. as well. But most of us don't live there. And while we should know what's happening there, a lot of times our kind of sending all of our attention to the top of culture has actually distracted us from doing what we can do where we are. And that's what we call aiming for the middle. And I think it's biblical, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all of your might, Paul says, to him who knows to do good and he doesn't do it, to him it is a sin. And, I think that kind of informs the fact that we should do anything we can do. And if we're getting distracted by watching, maybe too much of the news about how bad everything is and getting really upset about things we have no control over, it's going to keep us from doing things that we actually can do where we do have some control. But it also goes to kind of a something that comes out of that masterful analysis of the American experiment in the 1800s from Alexis de Tocqueville. And he came over and of course talked about, what he had seen in his book Democracy in America. He said a lot of different things, but one of the things he said that made America so, exceptional was that America was so strong in its middle. And what he meant by that is that it wasn't that it had this, strong government or that, there were these kind of, superhero individuals. It's that in between the big government and individuals was a very robust middle, a set of mediating structures like family and church and voluntary associations and so on. Take us into the current political debate. We're basically given a choice between, big government solving our problems, Supreme Court ruled today upholding, the health care plan from, President Obama and so on. Big government deserves, to have the opportunity to solve all of our problems. And then on the political right, we often hear kind of a libertarian individualism. Everyone should have autonomous individual freedom. Well, we know that, when big government doesn't have its power checked, it gets out of control. We also know that if individuals are not virtuous, then their freedom leads to vice. Their freedom leads even to anarchy and oppression. And so, an individual by himself cannot sustain his own freedom unless he has the ability to self-govern. And the institutions that teach us and cultivate us and curate in us an ability to be virtuous are these mediating institutions. And great political thinkers like Edmund Burke and of course, de Tocqueville is talking about this as well, looking at the strength of the family, the strength of the local church, the strength of local government. I know some of us think, man, I wish we could get some of those billions of dollars we spent on the last presidential election and invest in, you know, city council races and school boards. I mean, that would make an enormous difference. And so what we're doing in the book is calling people's attention back to the middle. And then we tell stories of Christians all over America. I mean, we all know the stories of Wilberforce and Bonhoeffer, and these are wonderful stories to know. But it's easy for us to say, well, I'm no Wilberforce, I'm no Bonhoeffer. Well, you read the stories in Restoring All Things, and Warren Smith is my co-author, a wonderful storyteller for World Magazine. World does an amazing job of telling the stories of Christians who are bringing hope and redemption to issues that government actually can't effectively address. And you learn these stories and you think to yourself, oh my goodness, there's a lot of hope left, right? I mean, there's Christians that are changing lives in everyday communities. And we hope that that instructs us about the sort of things that we ought to care about. I hope it instructs us about the sort of things that we can do about those things. And I hope it inspires us to go and do likewise.
Is it more important that we do something and maybe not do it well as opposed to not doing anything at all? You've got a great quote in there from William Brown. I'd be interested in your reaction. He says, one person committed to a cause is far more effective than 1,000 who are merely interested.
Yeah. You know, it is a great quote. Bill Brown was one of my mentors in college, and he used to say that. And it just basically, I mean, I think we live in a generation today, I think particularly in millennials, they have a kind of a heightened social awareness, certainly more than us Xers. And I think that's a good thing. But there's also the difference between being interested and being committed. And so, you know, one can feel today like they are actually doing something if they hit like on a Facebook post or, you know, sign a petition or something like that. And that's not the same. I mean, that's something, but that's not the same thing as being committed to a cause. And I think if someone is committed to a cause, they'll be committed not only, and especially committed to a cause as a Christian, they'll be committed not only to seeing that cause dealt with, but they'll be committed to the fact of the fundamentals of the faith. I mean, the fundamental convictions that Christians have about life and the world. So, for example, to help the poor, we have certain convictions about what it means to be human, and that has to come into play. In other words, we don't think just human, you know, poor, those that are in poverty or those that are kind of the beneficiaries of our assistance. What we believe is that every human being is made in the image and likeness of God and has a God-given purpose and a design. And so because of that, those who have taken a Christian worldview and applied it to helping those that find themselves in poverty, they've realized that the people themselves have an inherent dignity that's connected with their God-given design, which includes the dignity of creativity and the dignity of self-responsibility and also just the goodness of work. And that's why so many of these Christian organizations, and we tell about so many of them in the book, both locally and internationally, you know, they realize that those that are in poverty are not just beneficiaries of our help, they're actually participants. And when we give them, you know, the classic line is not just a handout, but a hand up, and we actually help them participate in their own freedom and, you know, in their own work and in their own solution, that it actually brings dignity instead of dependence. And, you know, again, you know, Brian Fickert's book, When Helping Hurts, really points to this. I mean, even last year, the year before, you know, Bono, the rocker with U2, said, you know, that what's working around the world is not aid. It's not just giving handouts. It's seeing poverty as more than just being a financial condition. If poverty were just financial, then the answer would be just financial. But poverty can be moral, and it can be relational, and it can be social. It could be, for example, the sort of poverty we have around the world is not the lack of resources. It's limited access to resources, such as capital and the rule of law. And so when Christians bring that to bear, and some of the great work that's being done around the world does that. So it's got to be both. It's got to be both heart and head when we seek to address some of the problems that we see in culture.
You know, as we talk about committed to a cause and social awareness, I mean, obviously, issues of poverty and injustice, you know, we maybe get those or can sort of everybody can agree on those, but then there are hot button issues and you address those as well, whether it's, you know, abortion or same-sex marriage and those things. I mean, maybe we haven't done quite so well on those, but there are still ways that what God is at work, right?
Well, no, there is. And I mean, I think even when you look at, for example, at, you know, part of the issue where it seems like we are, you know, quote unquote, losing the most having to do with really anything sexual. My friend Jay Richards called them the pelvic issues, and whether we're talking about same-sex marriage or sexual identity or, you know, things like that. I mean, look, I think that there are still examples of Christians doing remarkable things. The pro-life movement gives us an example of women who address the needs of the victims. Just like abortion has its victims, certainly unborn children, women and men as well, grandparents and grandmothers who are left without a grandchild, or aunts and uncles left without a niece or a nephew. And pregnancy care center movements have addressed those. Well, you know what? There are victims of the sexual revolution as well. There's victims, for example, of the transgender movement, where children as young as 8 who are kind of going through natural stages of gender identification are being kind of pushed away from their biological gender into one that's completely made up in their mind. There's going to be victims of this, and the church is going to have an opportunity to bring grace and care to these victims, just like the pro-life movement has done. Pro-life movement has also come up with sophisticated, thoughtful arguments to demonstrate the inherent dignity of all human lives, including those in the womb. Well, we also have researchers and so on that are at work on the sexual issues. There's also apologists in the pro-life community, those that are able to take those great ideas and translate them into usable, repeatable ways so that everyday Christians can, as Chuck Olson used to say, champion the Christian worldview over the backyard fence. Well, that needs to happen as well. So I see great hope even on these controversial issues. There's a lot of work left to be done, which gives me hope that we haven't exhausted all of our efforts. And I think we've got a great example in the pro-life movement that we can mimic. We have 4 questions in the book. 3 of the questions kind of fall out of the biblical story, I think, pretty cleanly. And then a 4th question, I think, comes from what it means to be made in the image of God. But we encourage Christians, as they look at their local communities, their own spheres of influence, their own opportunities, to ask these 4 questions. First of all, what's good that we can protect and promote? Christians should champion the good, the true, and the beautiful, whether it's art, whether it's religious liberty, whether it's human dignity. We should always be about championing the good. Secondly, what's missing that we can contribute? Great stories throughout history of believers who just looked and, because of their God-given creativity, their God-given care and entrepreneurship, were able to say, you know what, if this were only invented, or if this idea, if this law were in place, one, you know, we remember, for example, the Magna Carta, which we celebrated the 800th anniversary, this idea that the king is responsible to the law, the king doesn't make the law. I mean, what a remarkable idea that the world was missing that was contributed. What is missing that we can contribute? The 3rd one is what's evil that we can stop. Sometimes Christians find themselves in the flow of history, standing there yelling, stop, stop, stop. You know, kind of like that character in Pilgrim's Progress. Wilberforce said slavery must stop. And today's one of the stories we have in the book, Lila Rose, great activist for unborn children. Abortion must stop. Those that are dealing with sex trafficking, a whole bunch of organizations. Reggie Littlejohn, looking at forced abortions in China and the denigration of women in China. This has to stop. And then finally, what is broken that we can restore? And I think the most obvious answer to that is there's a bunch of relationships between fathers and children, between husbands and wives, between Christians and their community. Christians should be the ones reconciling relationships. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, God was in Christ reconciling men to himself and has given us the ministry of reconciliation. So those of us that are reconciled are to become agents of reconciliation. And that has to do with restoring and redeeming and renewing things that are broken.
Restoring All Things, the title of one of John Stonestreet's recent books, God's Audacious Plan to Change the World Through Everyday People. That's a conversation we had some time ago, and you can find that full conversation, as well as we'll post our fresh conversation today as we talk to Practical Guide to Culture with John Stonestreet. We'll have those on our webpage, the Connecting Faith show page at myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com. Just click on Connecting Faith to find the podcast archives there. And Ted, I was just so appreciate John Stonestreet. What a good thinker, and he's so able to communicate these important truths.
Yeah, a good resource for parents. I've gleaned a lot from today's conversation.
Yeah. You're going to want to listen to it, pass it on to a friend. Hey, tomorrow, a good conversation for parents as well. We're going to talk about fathers as we head into Father's Day and reference a new book called Hero, Being the Strong Father Your Children Needs from Dr. Meg Meeker. And she will join us here on Connecting Faith for that conversation. So hope that you'll be here as well. Thanks for listening as always, and thanks for your generous support of Faith Radio. Thanks for listening to this Connecting Faith podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support, and you can make a gift right now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Connecting Faith, you can subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the awareness and impact of Connecting Faith.